I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic. I'm Eric Edelman, and I am joined by my colleague, Elliot Cohen, who is my partner in this enterprise. And this is an emergency episode of Shield of the Republic, being taped shortly after the meltdown in the Oval Office between President Donald J. Trump and visiting President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. Elliot, to me, that was one of the low points of American statecraft in a very long time. I can't remember a moment lower than this. Can you think of one?
No, I mean, look, you and I are a pair of American patriots. And it is a terrible feeling to feel deeply ashamed of one's country, which is where I am now. I mean, it is shameful. You know, the idea that we're on the wrong side, that we're siding with, you know, evil predatory tyrants, and that, you know, not only are we siding with them, I mean, we've cut deals with actually Russian tyrants before. Although in a better cause, but you know this the egregious behavior to this courageous man who's been leading his country through, you know, a crucible that nobody in that room could possibly imagine. It makes you ill. I mean, it makes you ill and ashamed, and feeling, you know, sullied. Even though you and I obviously didn't have anything to do with it. I mean,
you and I should talk. I mean, my tendency is to think that this was something of a setup, probably by Vance. Is that your view too?
It was absolutely a setup. I think, you know, I don't know whether it was concerted with the president beforehand or whether Vance was, knowing the buttons to push with Trump, decided to resolve whatever lingering interagency differences there might be among, you know, Rubio and Waltz and Vance and others in the administration. But it was calculated. And I'm appalled that people like Lindsey Graham and others are saying, oh, Zelensky, you know, rose to the bait, you know, he shouldn't have done that, you know, or this was somehow his fault. This was a kind of calculated ambush. Again, I don't know whether Trump was in on it from the get-go or whether, you know, Vance did it, as I said, to, you know, for his own policy reasons. But, you know, as you and I were discussing before we came on, Neville Chamberlain and Edouard Daladier dealt with greater deference and subtlety with Edvard Beneš, the president of Czechoslovakia in 1938 at Munich, than these two, you know, schoolyard bullies did with Zelensky and with Mike Waltz and Marco Rubio, supposedly tough guys, you know, about Russia, looking on. Not only that, piling on, you know, after the fact, Rubio tweeting out, thank you, Mr. President, for standing up for America first in the Oval Office. You know, he's also made the point in responding to some of the criticism about the meeting in Riyadh, where Ukraine was excluded, in by saying that, well, Zelensky's just not very grateful for everything that's been done for him. Even Joe Biden was angry at him for not being grateful. You and I, on this very podcast, have spent a lot of time criticizing Biden for having been lacking in strategic empathy for a guy who was fighting for his life and for the life of his country. And yet this is where we are now, you know, that people are making these pathetic excuses that somehow this is the fault of the guy who's trying to stop a predatory, aggressive power from stealing his country.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, it's even worse for the Rubios and the Waltzes and the Grahams, you know, people who knew better, people who claimed to have some principles. I couldn't bear to be in the same room with them, you know. I mean, really, the people have so completely compromised their integrity. They're contemptible human beings, just contemptible human beings. But, I think Shield of the Republic, we vent, but we also, there's only so much of that we can and should do. I think it's also our job here to be analytic, to talk about what does this mean? What are the implications? If I could open it up just with one observation, you know, one interpretation of the Trump administration is, well, they're sort of isolationist. That's a long strand in American history. The current manifestation, well funded by the Koch brothers, is restraint. And I thought I would, just for the benefit of our listeners, I wanted to quote a very famous couple of lines from John Quincy Adams' July 4th, 1821, Independence Day address. Now, this is the one where he famously says that the United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And that's supposed to illuminate what a restrained foreign policy, if not indeed a neo-isolationist foreign policy, is like. But what people miss are the preceding sentence, in which he says there will be, and I quote, contests between inveterate power and emerging right. And then he says, wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her, America's heart, her benedictions and her prayers be. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She's the champion and vindicator only of her own. I mean, the point is that John Quincy Adams fully understood that the United States had to be an advocate for freedom. Now, what he's saying is we may not fight for it in other places. Fine, we can argue about that. And of course, he was saying that at a particular time. But there's no question in his mind that the American view of the world had to be shaped by some very, very fundamental values. In that respect, this administration is a break. It's an even bigger break than the much more sophisticated, nuanced, and in some ways limited break that you had under Nixon, sort of Nixon-Kissinger, where we also, you know, we threw an ally under the bus, South Vietnam, although, you know, we gave them more running room than, a lot more running room than we're giving Ukraine. But this is a break. This is, I don't think that much about Trump because he is who he is. I think he's somewhat senile. He's clearly, as you and I have often discussed, a malignant narcissist, a sociopath. I think what's very dark here is the role of J.D. Vance. I think you're absolutely right. He set this up. And I think he wants to take the country to a very dark place. And it's revealed, including in his affinity for people who believe in things that approach monarchy or dictatorship. So I think he's a very, very dangerous man, and I hope Americans wake up to that.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, one more vent before we, you know, get to the analysis. And it's, I'll try and make it a segue into analysis anyway. When people like Senator Lindsey Graham say, oh, this is Zelensky's fault, he rose to the debate, to the bait, rather, and got into a debate or a fight with Trump in the Oval, and he shouldn't have done that. I mean, if you watch the video, it would have been impossible for him to do anything other than what he did. Moreover, the people who are now saying, like Lindsey Graham, that, oh, the U.S.-Ukraine relationship irreparably torn can only be solved by Zelensky stepping down, they are objectively pro-Putin. They are objectively ewing to the Kremlin line. And that is, in fact, you know, what Dmitry Medvedev is already saying, you know, on Telegram and other, you know, Russian outlets. They are objectively pro-Putin. I don't care what Lindsey Graham says about how pro-Ukraine he is. He objectively now has signed himself up and aligned himself with Putin.
Yeah, as have all the other Trump apologists. You know, I'm
Right.
But okay, let's talk about what happens for here. One thing,
by the way, just to go back for 1 second, I totally agree with your assessment of J.D. Vance and what a dark character he is.
Yeah.
And you know, he is channeling some of the grossest, you know, anti-Ukraine, pro-Putin propaganda that people like David Sachs, you know, in Silicon Valley and others have been pumping into the internet and poisoning the sort of discourse in the United States, you know, by repeating essentially Russian disinformation.
It is a very dark form of authoritarianism, but obviously extends beyond that. I think, I mean, it's, you know, at some point the psychologists, the psychohistorians will explore, you know, what made him tick. But let's talk about Zelensky. You know, one thing that's of course, was very striking is when Trump was going on about, well, you know, he hasn't had an election in a number of years and he's a dictator. There was a resolution, which, of course, they ignored. And Trump probably doesn't even know about, in the Ukrainian parliament, which was virtually unanimous, saying, no, he really is our president. And we do have a law that says we're not going to have elections during wartime. You know, for actually quite understandable reasons. And I, you know, you were saying before we got on the air that it's not clear that this will make him any the less popular in Ukraine. I'm not sure it will, because the truth of the matter is that although some of this is personal with Zelensky, some of this has to do with Trump's affinity. Most of it has to do with Trump's affinity for Russia, his desire to cut deals. And I think, you know, if it was, you know, the mayor of Kyiv who was in that room, I don't think he would have been treated any better. I mean, may have been a little bit more afraid of him because he's a big guy and former boxer and could probably flatten all of them. But I you know, it wouldn't be any different. So I think there's that. And I think it's also important, you know, for us to remember that Ukraine is doing, in certain respects, it's doing much better than people think. I mean, the Ukrainian defense industry has taken off. It's being fed a lot of money by the Europeans. Hopefully it'll be fed a lot more. Technologically, they're actually doing quite well against the Russians, who, by the way, are not doing very well at all. So this is not the end for Ukraine. I mean, this is going to make things harder, unquestionably. And it makes you and me and others like us sick to our stomachs. But I don't think it's
literally.
Quite literally. I mean, would you agree with that assessment?
I agree totally. I don't know exactly how it will play in Ukraine. As you say, he did get a bump actually in the polls from Trump calling him a dictator. All of his, you know, prospective opponents in the election came out and said, yeah, we're under martial law. You know, we can't have an election in those circumstances. Well, half the country or 20% of the country is occupied and couldn't participate. I think there were also a lot of reservations about this mineral deal he was going to sign under duress. It was not the kind of deal he initially proposed, which was meant to be a kind of collateralization of, you know, of future U.S. support. It was supposed to have some kind of security guarantees attached to it. Obviously, none of that was happening. You know, this was all coming from, you know, this was all going to be forward-looking. Trump has turned it into a, no, you have to pay us back for all the assistance we gave you before. And he's talked about $300 billion. He reiterated that number. I think he said $350 billion. In U.S. aid to Ukraine. Now, we all know that that number is not the real number. So where did that number come from? How did that lodge in Trump's brain is an interesting question. There's reporting in the Ukrainian press that suggests that this came ultimately from Kirill Dmitriev, who was the head of the Russian Sovereign Wealth Fund, U.S. educated, very smooth, went to Stanford, Harvard Business School, worked at Goldman Sachs. Speaks pretty good English. So, of course, you know, stupid Americans think that anyone else who's a foreigner who speaks English must be smart. That's one of the defects of, you know, sort of amateur.
And a good guy.
Yeah, amateur diplomacy.
Right.
Steve Witkoff, who is the negotiator, I think got that number from Dmitriev, who told him, that's the opportunity cost, that you could have had all this business in Russia that you gave up to support Ukraine, and that that was fed back into Trump, whose brain it's lodged in, and that became the kind of occasion for all of this demanding of repayment for $300 billion in assistance. So, I mean, I think this is, I think maybe going to go down pretty positively for Zelensky in Ukraine, that in the end of the day, he didn't sign this agreement.
Let's talk about, the Ukrainians will fight on because this is really about life. I mean,
right. Survival.
It's survival. And by the way, people say, well, you should have been nicer. If you were in the room sitting next to somebody and they're talking about the guy who raped your daughter and they're saying to you, well, he's actually a really pretty good guy. See how many of them could have been restrained. I think that, the big question is, I think the Europeans are finally waking up or woken up. And I think this sort of seals it. I mean, there was the Hexas speech that was rough, but it wasn't totally out of the norm. As I said, it was kind of Bob Gates with bad manners at a certain level. The Vance speech definitely shook them up. This has to convince them, if anything, is that you cannot trust the United States under the Trump administration. And they will be absolutely right to think that. Now, the question is, can they mobilize the resources and the power to sustain Ukraine throughout that? And I don't know. I mean, I think that it is striking that Ukraine has this big defense industry, which is they are pumping money into, which is doing well. There's been a lot of stuff that's been happening quite quietly, particularly with the Nordics, the Brits, and some of the others. There've been interesting moves. One thing that I thought was really interesting is Tayyip Erdogan said, "Yeah, we're willing to put Turkish troops into Ukraine." Which, I know...
That's part of a peacekeeping operation.
I know you're not the biggest fan of Tayyip Erdogan, but the truth of the matter is Turkish troops in opposite Crimea, I think, would be a good thing. I mean, because like the Poles, they're willing to kill Russians. And they have a genuine kind of strategic stake in not letting the Russians dominate the Black Sea.
I agree with that up to a point. I mean, I would want them to be part of a European multilateral force, not the only force there.
Of course.
I agree. Look, I completely agree with your point about the Europeans. And so there's been an outpouring on Twitter of support from the Prime Minister of Finland, Prime Minister of Sweden, the Baltic Prime Ministers, Prime Minister of Belgium, the Danish Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas, the EU Foreign Affairs Commissioner, former Prime Minister of Estonia, who, by the way, Marco Rubio snubbed this week and refused to meet.
Outrageously. I mean, she was already here.
Yeah, disgusting.
They said, scheduling problems.
Disgusting, short-sighted, bad, not only bad manners, bad diplomacy.
It was a lie. I mean,
all nonsense. So that in the first instance, that is, a good thing. As you say, the question is, how will they translate that into real support and what can they do? And here I'm a little worried that, this is going to get caught up in this debate that the German election and the victory of, Chancellor to be Merz has kicked off about how will Europe pump up its own defense. And in particular, are they going to create, a bank like the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development that they set up after the fall of the Berlin Wall to help rebuild the former Soviet bloc countries of the Warsaw Pact that were becoming members of the EU? Will they create something like the EBRD for defense? Or will they create some other special purpose vehicle to fund defense with concessionary loans, et cetera, et cetera? They don't have time for this, in my view. I mean, that's fine to have that discussion and go ahead and do it. But the Ukraine piece of this is going to have to be on a much faster timeline, not the sort of very sedate Euro bureaucratic timeline that you know, work in Brussels sometimes can take on.
So, Eric, let me ask you this question. If you were talking candidly to American allies now, and they were to ask you, does this mean we should get nuclear weapons? What would you say?
Well, I did have a talk with actually a mutual friend of ours who comes from a allied nation, who I won't name and won't specify. He may have reached out to you. And I basically said he had given a presentation about his country's relationship with the United States. And then, you know, the fourth part of it, four-part presentation was, you know, what's happening here? And I told him, you know, your presentation, and he put it in terms of, well, you know, it's not clear which direction the Trump administration is going to go. There are these isolationist, you know, strands, but on the other hand, there's also, you know, they want to contain China, and they, you know, there are these more hawkish elements, and the Republican Party in the Congress is a bit more traditional, blah, blah, blah. And I said, this is all very nice, but, you know, way too optimistic, you know, and that this is going to be very bad 4 years, that you guys are going to have to think about going, you know, I mean, what I suggested was not nuclear weapons. I don't think we're there yet, although that is clearly, I think, a long-term issue. And we should not forget that Sweden had a nuclear weapons program until the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, Germany was debating and is now talking about nuclear sharing in NATO again, as it did in the late 50s and early 1960s. Debate in South Korea is very real. Australia had a nuclear weapons program until the 1970s.
There is a quiet debate in Poland right now.
Yeah. And that's going to continue. My recommendation to people is continue to try and preserve as much as you can of your connection with the United States that goes on through more formal bureaucratic channels that have not yet been disrupted and may not get disrupted by all the churn, you know, at the top, while also working as closely with other allies as you can on the assumption that the United States might not be there when you need them and that you have to be able to defend yourselves.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I would be only somewhat more blunt and say, for the next 3 years and 11 months, you cannot trust this American administration. Yeah. I mean, in a fundamental way, that you, no matter what their treaty commitments are, no matter what they tell you, even if you get it directly from the president, you cannot be sure that they're not lying to you or they won't sort of turn on a dime and align with the bad guys. And, you know, there's a follow-on question for that, which is, you know, will we ever recover from this? I mean, and I mean, that we'll be talking to Michael Beckley about this next week, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, my feeling is, no, we're not going to completely recover from this. I mean, after this, I think you'd have to be a fool to really trust the word of the United States. And I can't tell you how much it grieves me to say that. Now, there are probably plenty of people around the world saying, actually, we've known that for quite some time. Thank you very much. And they have some reason to say those things. So I'm, you know, I probably getting a bit too much of my high horse. But I do think this is qualitatively different. I mean, this is, it is so egregious, such a reversal of our values. It's, you know, such an abandonment of our values and of our policies that, is, you know, something's broken and you can't, this is not one you can put back together again.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, one, I think this is now going to be a huge test for the American people, who by and large don't pay much attention to, you know, foreign affairs as our Bulwark colleague, you know, JVL always points out. This is not, you know, this is not something people spend a lot of time worrying about, but this is really going to be a test because we've changed sides, you know, essentially, you know, and you were quoting David Frum before we came on, and you might want to repeat what David said about this, but I don't think, I could be wrong. I could be misjudging the American public. I mean, I've misjudged the public before. I've been wrong about a lot of election results in the last decade. It staggers me still that Donald Trump won the popular vote. I thought he might win the election. It never occurred to me he would actually win the popular vote. So I could be wrong about this, but I think this is going to stick in their craw. I don't think this bullying of someone who, you know, manifestly has thanked the United States in front of the entire United States Congress.
Repeatedly.
You know, that somehow he's the villain here and these objectively pro-Putin people are, you know, not the, you know, the sponsors of this moment and, you know, lining themselves up essentially with evil. I also think that they believe that, or some of them are persuading themselves that this is really a very sophisticated, Bismarckian or Metternichian move, that this is like, as some of them have described it, the reverse Kissinger. You know, we're going to pull Russia away from its embrace of China. And there's a terrific leader in The Economist that just went up a day or so ago, which points out the folly of thinking this is A, a strategy, or B, that it has remotely much chance of success.
Yeah. Well, and whatever these guys are, you know, miniature Metternichs and, you know, wannabe Talleyrands, they are most definitely not. You know, the David Frum piece that you mentioned was a very short piece that just dropped. At least it's called At Least Now We Know the Truth. It's David Frum. And the last paragraph I found very powerful. The good and great America that once inspired global admiration, that good and great America still lives. But it no longer commands a consensus above party. The pro-Trump party exposed its face to the world in the Oval Office today. Nobody who saw that face will ever forget the grotesque sight.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I think that's true. What does this mean for people like you and me? I mean, we just rage for 4 years?
Well, as we've said before on this podcast, you know, keeping one's balance, you know, in this time is going to be very, very difficult. I think a lot of people have been trying not to respond to the outrage. I think today actually did break something. I mean, I'm not sure about your phone. My phone just blew up. And it blew up with a lot of former officials, you know, going, what the fuck? I mean, you know, you know, just from a lot of different quarters, including quarters one might not have expected it.
I heard from a very tough-minded political scientist I know, who's sort of right of center, and he said, this one broke me.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it is the spectacle of us being on the wrong side. No, I agree. It's going to be a struggle for us to keep our, you know, stay level-headed. But I think that, you know, the problem is also this, together with all the other lunacy that these people are embarked on, is we're going to be in an extraordinarily turbulent time.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily turbulent. I mean, something that you and I have not seen in our lifetimes, and I will include, you know, all the upheavals of the late 60s, which you and I both remember, even though we were a lot younger then.
Yeah, and I had more hair. In 1968, I remember thinking that the country was having a kind of national nervous breakdown, which I think it did to some degree. And I've been thinking about that quite a bit recently, because even in the midst of that, I never felt quite as much despair as I feel right now about the way things are going, in part because we're only 5 weeks into this. I mean, which is, you know, hard to believe. And because there's so much damage that can be done. And I know people are waiting, you know, for the next opportunity that people have to go to the ballot box, and that's the remedy, which it is to some degree, for what's going on. But you know, we're, you know, sort of 5 months out from an election in Virginia, which I am fairly confident Abigail Spanberger will win, and that will be good. But, you know, she's a governor. She's one lone governor. And, you know, even if Mikey Sherrill, who is sort of her, you know, analog in New Jersey, wins, that's just two governors, you know, and it'll be another year before the Democrats have a chance to take at least one of, you know, the houses of Congress back. I'm just not sure how much damage, you know, can actually be sustained by the country, you know, over that time. I mean, I really worry, you know, that we're going to see violence. I mean,
I think we will.
You've seen the, you know, the assassination attempt, the assassination of a healthcare executive and the attempt on another healthcare executive's life. You know, I'm fearful that we're going to see more of this.
Look, I am too. I mean, I just think of all the federal employees who've been sacked and, you know, and have been sacked in a particularly cruel and egregious way. And some of those people will go off their heads and probably begin gunning for the people who did it. And, you know, then you're off to the races. I think, you know, for myself.
They're also being recruited, by the way, according to the intelligence community, by Russian and Chinese intelligence. That's another, well, you know.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, I'm sure we took advantage of, you know, unhappiness about the invasion of Ukraine, and now they're doing the same to us. You and I are at the end of our careers in many ways, but for me, the most important thing I think is that it's really important to use clear language about this and to call evil, evil. And I think particularly for those of us who are in Washington, I mean, I'm sure, I know, you know, we both know the kinds of people who will say, well, you've got to talk to them, you know, and, you know, you want to sort of keep your lines open to the administration and, you know, more talk to the reasonable people. I think, in general, there's always a kind of subtle pressure to talk in very neutral, policy-oriented terms. And while there's some role for that, I think this is really a time that requires some moral lucidity. And Václav Havel, in actually much worse times, let's face it, than we're experiencing, said, live in truth. And I think that's what we got to do. And, you know, really be very forceful in depicting the truth and not accommodating ourselves to these people. I mean, it's a hard thing for those of us who, you know, live in these circles where you're going to be seeing these people. I don't want to be in the same room with them. I just.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, my own personal view of this is anybody who calls me and asks for advice, I'm happy to give it, but I'm certainly not seeking anybody out to try and help them or advise them or flatter myself that if I, you know, whisper the right thing in the right person's ear, it's going to have much of an impact.
It'll have no effect.
Well, it you know, frankly, it won't have much effect because you can already see that this is such a personalized regime. And I've been U.S. ambassador to one of those. So I know how that works. Yeah. You know, the only voice that matters ultimately is, you know, the president in this instance. And we've already seen him, you know, release a video this week. Did you see that video of the Trump Gaza video?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The AI generated Trump Gaza video with the gold statue of Trump in the middle of Gaza City.
You know, the thing is, look, even the halfway reasonable people in the administration, or people we would normally think of as halfway reasonable, first they had to compromise themselves in order to come on board because they had to say things which they had to know were not true about the 2020 election and about January 6th. But they're working for morally corrupt people. I mean, all of them, every last one of them, morally corrupt. You can't do that and keep your soul. And honestly, you can't do that and hope to do good. You really can't. I mean, it's the argument of the Vichy bureaucrat
said, well, you know, maybe I can do some good. No, you can't. All you can do is you can make things worse. That's all.
So let me ask you this. You and I think have had a slight disagreement about whether Trump might consider running for a third term in 28. You think he's trolling when he says that? I think he's testing the waters.
I think he's perfectly capable of doing that, but I think so. He's perfectly capable of doing it. You know, does he have any compunctions about the Constitution? No. Does he even know what's in the Constitution? No. Do people like Vance respect the Constitution? I don't think so.
No.
So no. But I also think that this is a guy who has a very limited attention span, who, you know, gets an idea and kind of runs with it, and then gets another idea and runs with it and free associates. I do think he's in the beginnings, maybe not even the beginnings, of a real senile decline. I mean, I expect him to be quite as gaga in his own charming way as Biden was at the end of his term, when he'll be in his early 80s and he will be kind of babbling and incoherent, even more babbling and incoherent than he is now.
All right. So let me ask you one other question. And this was, you know, with my tongue only partially inserted into my cheek, having watched the Trump Gaza video with the gold statue, what do you think the over under is that he declares himself a god by the end of the term?
You know, so here's the book that if you want to make, which is a great read, but if you want to make yourself really miserable, read Robert Harris's 3-volume set of novels about Cicero in the Republic and the end of the Roman Republic, because that's what's happening, you know.
Yeah, I read Conspirata. I haven't read the others.
They're actually, if you listen to my books on tape, because that's a great reader, and he's such a good storyteller that, you know, there's something about hearing a story orally. You know, that's the kind of world you're in. But that, you know, to your earlier, more serious point, that's there you're talking about violence. I don't think we're going to come to civil war if that's it. But I do think you're going to get political violence. Absolutely. I will not be surprised. And it'll go in both directions. I think that's, you know, sometimes I think like the MAGA types think they're the only ones who own guns. And I assure you they are not. And they will find out the hard way if they try things. So I do think there's probably going to be political violence, which is appalling. And at a time when the country, you know, you could almost sort of understand it over the Civil War, but over this, I mean, it's...
Right.
Meanwhile, here's what I'm doing. I'm clutching.
So what was that Marx said about, the, you know, all history happens twice. The first time is tragedy. The second time is farce. Twice,
yeah. So this is my mug. And if you're on, those of us who are seeing us on YouTube should be able to read it. It says, freedom is in peril. Defend it with all your might. So this is, everybody's familiar with the Keep Calm and Carry On posters. So actually that was one of three posters that the British printed up during World War II, but that they never actually distributed. So Keep Calm and Carry On was not seen during World War II. These three posters, there's that one, there's this one, freedom is in peril, defend with all your might. And then I think the other one says, your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory. They were only supposed to be put up when in the event of an invasion. That's where Keep Calm and Carry On was going to be. You're going to see that when the Germans invaded, or this one. So I'm keeping this mug out because I think it's time to put up the posters.
All right. Well, I think that's where we'll leave it for this emergency edition of Shield of the Republic. Elliot, thanks for joining on short notice. Thanks for sharing, you know, my moment of hate that we were able to indulge in.
We'll always have our hate together, you know.
And look forward to seeing you on Monday with Michael Beckley. And I don't know if you've got Alex Vindman's book yet. You should have it shortly. I just got it today, and I think we're going to try and have Alex on soonish.
Good. Good, good, good.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsafe the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsafe the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsafe the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.